Hey, hockey heads, get ready for the Daily Faceoff Playoff Parlay Challenge. Each game day, answer four questions. Pick the winning team, guess if points will be over or under, predict the first goal, and choose the highest scoring period. Daily winners snag gift cards, while each round's champs pocket cold, hard cash. Play now at games.dailyfaceoff.com and prove your puck prowess. It's fast, it's fun, and it's all about hockey. Let's go.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Welcome to the DFO Rundown Podcast with Frank Saravalli and Jason Greger on DailyFaceoff.com. Delivered by DoorDash.
Welcome to episode 126 of the DFO Rundown. I'm Jason Greger, alongside Frank Saravalli. Tyia Remchuk is off today. He's in Los Angeles for game three. It's a little too early for him to join us this morning. And Frank, I hope you're doing well. All I know is I should have had a video before we came on today of you battling with your earpiece, because that would be like a perfect short video film that people would get a good chuckle out of.
Yeah, I'm not sure what the issue was there. All I know is I've been using the same earpiece for the last year and a half, and for whatever reason today it decided to stop working.
Oh, it's tough.
Guess that's how it works.
Earpiece one, Frank, nothing. But you battled back, Frank. You battled back. You're like the Dallas Stars. Dallas Stars, how about this, man? We got six series tied at one. Colorado-Nashville and Carolina-Boston are the only series where the home team has won both games. And I want to start with the Dallas-Calgary series, because the Calgary Flames were tied with Minnesota and Florida for the best goal differential 5-on-5 this year. They were plus 57. Their top line scored, just their forwards, not to mention if any D-men were on the ice, they scored 77 goals as a line, second most in the NHL. The Flames don't have one 5-on-5 goal through two games. Now, they've only scored one. And
I was going to say, they've scored one goal, period, yeah. Which is also cause for concern.
Yeah, and Dallas has only scored two. It's obviously the lowest scoring series by a mile, but are you surprised at the lack of offense from Calgary, who was pretty much a juggernaut offensively all season?
I am. I mean, I think it's cause for concern, because I think when you get to this point in the playoffs and you have a lot of expectations and you have a core that has had previous failures, a lot of times due to their lack of scoring touch or production when it comes to the playoffs, you know, it becomes a real thing. I mean, you take a look, even just going back to, you know, the bubble in 2020, the last time these two teams met in the playoffs. I mean, it's been, you know, a little bit tough to come by in terms of production. Matthew Tkachuk, he only played in four out of the eight games, one assist. Elias Lindholm, one goal in eight games. Andrew Mangiapane, one goal in eight games. Johnny Gaudreau, two goals in eight games. That's the two games this series and the six that they played in the bubble. And all of a sudden you go, huh, what does that mean? And it's not even so much what does it mean, because it's easy, not easy, but it's possible that they bust out of that slump at some point during this round and the floodgates open. But when you have that kind of history, I just think it adds pressure and it becomes a mental grind as much as anything else.
Yeah. So that's a series to watch. Staying out west, Edmonton special teams is absolutely destroying the Los Angeles Kings. The Oders are 50% on the power play. They haven't given up a penalty kill goal, but they've actually scored shorthanded. So their net penalty kill is above 100%. And they were very physical in game two. Obviously Mike Smith had the blunder in game one, but other than that, Edmonton game two, they really had their way. And I'll be curious to see what kind of adjustments the Kings can make. I just think their inexperienced, smaller defense corps, really, that's what Edmonton attacked in game two. And I expect that to continue.
How do you think the Oilers better handled the matchup game in game two? You know, Deneau and Kopitar going against the Oilers' top guys was such a big storyline from game one. Didn't seem to be as big of a deal in game two. And now that the series shifts to LA, where the Kings have last change, how does that impact it?
It might, but it's interesting. Deneau's line scored two goals against Nugent Hopkins' line in game one. Now, granted, one of them was, of course, a Smith gaffe, so I don't necessarily push that line. The Deneau line and Moore and I follow, they were the best line. Kopitar's line really hasn't done much in the series thus far. So, I think if you're Jay Woodcroft, you got me saying Todd now. If you're Jay Woodcroft, I don't think you're concerned Connor McDavid on which line he plays against, to be honest. I think they'll take that, whichever matchup LA wants to try to go with, they'll do it. Anze Kopitar played a load of 25 minutes, almost 5 minutes more than he normally does in the regular season. In game one, he was back down closer to 20 in game two when it was a blowout. So there's no reason to overuse him. But I really think the matchup where LA struggles, Frank, is they just don't have a defense pair. Right. Like, we can talk about the forward lines, but usually you've got that, that really good shutdown defensive pair to match up against the other team's best players. And without Drew Doughty, LA just doesn't have that.
Yeah, I agree. That's been the big missing ingredient. So the Oilers seem to be out of the woods. The Panthers seem to be out of the woods with a big bounce back 5-1 win over the Caps in game two. Their offense was sort of what we expected it to be finally. One team that I'm not entirely sold after evening their series that is out of the woods is the New York Rangers. And there's been a lot of talk about, Louis Domingue and the Penguins being down to their third goalie. And what does that mean for the series as Tristan Jarry tries to work his way back? Not sure how much eyes you had on that game, looking back on Thursday night, but when you look at the opportunities that Sidney Crosby has had in this series,
yeah,
if the Rangers don't find a way to get him in check, their season is on the line.
Yeah, you know what, Frank? It's really smart that you brought that up, because Sidney Crosby's been unreal in this series. If you just look at the points, you'd be like, okay, he's been all right. But man, his quality chances, the amount that he has produced, I thought in game one, even, Frank, he was unreal for the Penguins all over the ice, at his age, just dominating. And, the big fear for the Rangers was briefly there when Shesterkin went down late in the third period. Oh my goodness, if they'd have lost him, that would have been devastating.
That was a really odd sequence.
Yeah, it was. And Pittsburgh, I give them credit, because really for the 3 months they were a below average team really in the NHL, and their playoff experience here has come to the forefront. I think it's fair to wonder about the goaltending. Like, if you got to go Shesterkin against the other team's number three goalie, you would think in a longer series that is going to benefit the Rangers. But you're right, they've got to find a way to check Crosby better, because he's kind of had free reign to do whatever he wants, and eventually some of those chances are going to start going in.
I agree. And I had this sort of, I don't want to say realization, but sort of self-reckoning at some point when filling out my ballot, saying, am I getting this wrong, not having Crosby in the heart conversation? And I know that his numbers don't stack up anywhere near the guys that, are really in contention for the award, but I think his season was really sneaky good. That didn't really get a lot of talk or conversation over the last, 45, 50 games of the season. You look at his last 43 games, Jason, 26 goals, 60 points in 43 games. Like, he was as good as anyone down the stretch, and it went largely unnoticed. I don't know why we started sleeping on Sidney Crosby, but we did. And, you see these first two games, it's a reminder, like, this guy's damn good.
Oh, yeah. I think, honestly, that there was just so many other candidates, Yossi and Matthews and McDavid and Kaprizov and Goudreau and, you know, just go down the list of other guys that you would say, hey, Huberdeau, of course.
Shesterkin.
Shesterkin. And so it wasn't so much that, you know, Crosby, you're right, his second half was unbelievable. But because his first half, he just probably doesn't get in the conversation because the other guys were just more consistent all year. But you're right, Crosby's second half of the season, you would put him right up there with anyone else. And they've continued that. And, you know, the Rangers, maybe a little bit lucky to get out of it, you know, at home, tied one. And, you know, maybe it was just a little bit of, you know, they've got more youthfulness. You know, Malkin scores the overtime winner. Chris Letang has been very good. Sidney Crosby's dominated. And you just see playoff experience, Frank. It's no joke. And you're seeing it from certain players in a lot of these series. And that's why, you know, you look to Tampa and Toronto now. It's a best of five. They're tied at one. And statistically, I do want to point this out. You know, a lot of times everyone says, oh, look, you know, Edmonton, Minnesota, Toronto, they've all lost home ice advantage. Well, historically, if you look at when the series is tied at one in the history of the NHL, when the series
it's
is
exactly
tied at
500.
One, yeah, it's 500. 50-50. But the teams who still win the series, 57% of the time, it's the team who had home ice advantage to start. So Minnesota, Edmonton, Toronto, all those teams, the Rangers, the odds are that they still, even though they've, quote, lost home ice advantage, odds suggest they still have a better chance to win the series. Now, obviously,
yeah, but the reason for that, I would believe, has nothing to do with home ice advantage, has everything to do with the fact that they went in being the better team.
Yeah. Sure. And that's
7% margin is the difference.
Yeah, exactly. And so I look at like the Tampa Toronto series to me, and really that's a microcosm, Frank, of the playoffs so far this year for me. There's been 16 games. 9 of them have been 3 or more goal differential, like blowouts. 9 of the 16.
It actually hasn't been that fun. There hasn't been the drama that we are used to.
Yeah, there's only been
the triple overtime game was really dramatic.
It was great. That was it. The you know, the Flames had the 1-0 game that came down to the wire. Nashville, Colorado. Now, you know, Connor Ingram kept that game close because
what an awesome story he is.
He was unreal for the Predators as Colorado just overwhelmed them. But that's what overtime can do sometimes. Had the Preds won that game, you wonder if maybe that gives them a reason to believe. But you know, Ingram, they kind of spoiled a stellar performance by him by losing it in overtime. But
how about Cale Makar?
Oh,
he scores so good, on his 22nd shot attempt of the game. 22nd. How for some guys in the league, how many games does it take them to get to 22 shot attempts? Yeah. 5? Wow. 6?
Yeah, he's all over the place, man. Like, that's just a real mismatch on the ice, especially when you take out UC Saros. But look at Ingram. Like, I'm not sure Saros could have played much better than he did in game two, and they still lost. Colorado, Frank, they never iced a fully healthy lineup until game one of the playoffs. And we've seen it through two games. Like, they are a wagon. That's going to be a tough team. Whether, you know, if you're St. Louis or Minnesota, man, that's going to be a real tough out in round two.
I have a hot takey question for you. Is Nathan MacKinnon the best playoff player ever who hasn't won anything?
You know, it's funny, Frank, because I wrote an article at the start of the playoffs about how elite players, it's hard for them to really elevate their game in the playoffs because most of them score so much. But then Nathan MacKinnon's the one guy who does it. Like, he's had some really good regular seasons, but then he just goes, he goes atomic in the playoffs. Like, he just dominates and elevates his game. It's probably, I'm trying to think of guys who would be that good. Yeah, like, you know, I remember Ovechkin for a while, Frank. Like, remember the years that they didn't get out of this? One year he had 21 points in 14 games, and people like, oh, yeah, Ovechkin's not leading their team. I'm like, what the hell else is he supposed to do? But yeah, you're right. MacKinnon's been all world for Colorado. And the thing is, the last 2 years, I believe injuries played a major role in them not going deeper in the playoffs. Eric Johnson injury last year was catastrophic. Mm-hmm. And the year before, in the bubble, they're down to like 3 goalies in one series. Like, if they stay healthy, man, that's a real tough team to beat.
So Alex Ovechkin, 0.96 points per game. Pretty damn good. But he is 48th all time.
Yeah.
So Nathan MacKinnon is fourth.
Fourth.
It's Gretzky, Lemieux. Here's one that I was not expecting. Barry Peterson.
Oh, yeah.
From the Boston Bruins. He played 33 games.
Okay.
So he had, 34 games. He has 52 points, which is actually pretty decent. But if you make it a minimum of 50 games, which McKinnon has hit, Gretzky, Lemieux, McKinnon.
Yeah.
And then it's a big gap between McKinnon and Mark Messier and Bobby Orr.
Yeah. And it's crazy about games played because like Messier and those guys were doing that in 200 games. Right. So yeah, McKinnon so far has been, he's their leader of their team. No question. Come playoff time. He's just a highly, he's able to elevate his emotions, Frank, where it doesn't overwhelm him. He just becomes like a bull in a china shop. He's so powerful and like,
it's hard to do that. Yes. It's hard to rev yourself up without crossing the line.
Yeah.
Because some guys are so revved up that they can't handle it.
Yeah. Like he just looks like he gets shot out of a cannon so often when he exits the
look at that first period goal.
Oh, jeez. He's so like, it's funny. McKinnon and McDavid are both so fast, but they look so different doing it.
Yes. Why is that? Is it the size?
Well, I'm not, McKinnon's definitely thicker a little bit, but I find
thicker.
It's their skating stride to me that looks quite different. McDavid's a little bit more upright and McKinnon's more bent over and he just explodes. And McDavid is just so light on his feet. Like McKinnon's more of like a powerful skater where McDavid, when he's flying, it's like his, you know, he's a little like Makar and Bobby Orr and Paul Coffey. Like it's like their skates are barely touching the ice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting. I'd be curious to have someone break that down, look at the difference. But they're both equally effective, just totally different style.
Yeah. The Minnesota St. Louis series, it's been blowouts, two of them. Do you see any team that you think has a slight advantage heading into game three?
Not really. I think it's still a total coin flip. I liked from Minnesota the fact that Kaprizov, who looked really frustrated in game one, was able to bounce back with that hat trick. The funny thing about game two from Minnesota's perspective is that St. Louis actually really dominated the first 10 minutes of the game. And you're thinking, oh man, the Blues are in the driver's seat here. And they capitalized on a freak play. Bortuzzo, his stick explodes. They score and it was like off to the races. That's all they needed. That the building exploded, everything happened. And now they go to St. Louis and that, no surprise, that grief line has been a handful. Green, Eriksson Ek, Foligno. It's going to be interesting to see the way the matchup game shifts a little bit as well. Like how does Craig Berube begin to dictate, you know, what's happening? If anything, he's not a huge, I don't think he's a huge disciplined matchup guy.
Well, and the other thing, Frank, is injuries on the Blues blue line. The Bortuzzo injury was ugly. And what, they got three guys now down? Like that to me is it's similar, reminding me of the 2006 Buffalo Sabres. Now, granted, it was later in the playoffs where, you know, they couldn't find a defenseman to stay healthy. And that ultimately cost them that series against Carolina. And with Minnesota and St. Louis fairly evenly matched, I know there's a slight advantage for Minnesota to start the series. But you all of a sudden see that many defensemen get injured. That to me might be the ultimate difference maker here. And, you know, Berube's been very quiet in St. Louis on what the extent of the injuries are. And, you know, we'll see if guys can come back. But if they don't get some of their defensemen back here in this series, Frank, that might be the difference. You talk about the grief line. You take out some of those bigger St. Louis defensemen, now that's even tougher to defend that line.
Yeah, it's Bortuzzo. Looks like Bortuzzo, Scandella, and Leddy.
Yes.
So all of a sudden, when you're transitioning to, you know, Nico Mikkola, Callie Rosen, you know, the next guys down on your list, it's becomes a different ballgame. You can't take out half of your defense corps and expect to be the same team.
Yeah, like Parayko, Falk, and Krug, man. Are they all going to play 25, 27 minutes? They might
probably have to. Yeah, they're going to have to.
Yeah, so that's a – I never – I like to see the best of the best. I just find the playoffs are better that way. I don't like injuries on any team. I know it can play a huge part in it. Injury, when it's all good teams, and if you're in the playoffs, you're a good team. Obviously, some are better than others, but you can make a huge difference in your lineup just based on injuries alone if you start to get key ones. And mm-hmm. You know that's what I'll be watching for in that series. Boston, speaking of injuries, Lindholm got absolutely smoked. It was a clean hit. You could hear even his teammates on the ice were yelling heads up. And you know, it's interesting. Jason Strudwick tells me he didn't like that pass. They don't like that pass from defensemen. Sometimes it can put you in a tough spot. And, you know, Lindholm got absolutely rocked. I don't think he's returning for this playoffs. Like, he was clearly, you know, on wobbly street there.
Yeah. And same thing with Rickard Rakell in Pittsburgh after that Lindgren hit.
So you,
talk again on Monday, will the Bruins season still be alive?
I think they can win a game in Boston. For sure. But yeah, Carolina looks really good right now.
26-4. That's how much Carolina has outscored them in five games in the season series.
Yeah, it's nuts.
I don't care who Boston puts in net. Swayman, you could resurrect Tuukka Rask from the dead. Like, I don't
offense.
Yeah, you need to score. And first off, you need some confidence. The frustration, the Derek Forbort / high stick is as dumb as it gets. Stuff like that, you see that emanating from their game. David Pastrnak really struggled in game two. What's the sign of hope? Like, I don't know. It feels to me like Hurricanes, you know, they're heading towards Sweep City.
Yeah, like they really controlled those two games at home. And
even when things got tight,
yeah,
they were still like, okay, yeah, no problem.
Yeah, they never looked in jeopardy in any of that. Now, Grant, I didn't watch a full every minute of those, but I probably watched, I would say, 4.5 periods out of 6. And every time I watch it, Carolina just seemed to be controlling the game. Mm-hmm. There seemed very few stretches where the Bruins were able to just grab momentum and hold on to it for an extended period of time. And they're going to have to find a way to do that. Marchand, Bergeron, Pastrnak, Hall, if your best guys aren't going, and you mentioned the goal for differential, Frank, like, come on, if you can't score, I don't care. Like, you can hope to win games 1-0 or 2-0, but that's pretty hard to do long term. They got to get going offensively. There's no two ways about it. And they could go with Swayman. You're right. Like, I don't think Allmark was the reason they lost either one of those games. And they might switch the goaltender. I understand if they do it, but
they said they're going to Swayman.
Yeah. So
but I don't care who they put in that. It's not. Yeah. I don't look at the first two games and say, okay, that was on Linus Allmark.
No, not at all.
So the only series we didn't really dive in on is the Leafs and Lightning.
Oh, that's, you know, it was interesting. You know, in Toronto, they're talking about, hey, we took too many undisciplined penalties. We got to be better. And that's fair. No question. Tampa Bay, and it's hard for me. Just I talked earlier about playoff experience and Tampa Bay, like the fact that they're 15-0, Vasilevskiy has 5 shutouts after they lose a game. Like how you respond after a loss is so key. And no one's been better than them. That's obviously why they're the 2-time defending champs here the last few seasons. And now I'll be curious to see, can Toronto rebound with the same force and vigor that Tampa Bay did?
I don't have an answer. I don't know, because it's so odd that this playoff series has in a way mirrored the way their season series wrapped up. It was Leafs blowout followed by Lightning blowout. And that's how this series has started as well. I don't think any team has any advantage one way or the other. I mean, the only question mark I have is I thought the Leafs handled themselves really well after game one. They said all the right things. We know we're going to, you know, essentially they knew they were getting a better effort from Tampa in game two. They were ready for it. Yet when Tampa threw the punch, you know, they didn't respond very well.
Yeah. And like, I think, you know, Tampa Bay, I do believe in urgency, Frank, at some points when you're an experienced team. And not that Toronto was comfortable by winning game one by any stretch of the imagination, but I just think Tampa Bay was the more desperate team. And, you know, Toronto might be to start that game. But I think you go back to Tampa, it's going to be a madhouse. And Toronto, the start of the game is going to be key for me. Is how does Toronto start? Because I'm not sure Toronto can ask for much more. Their top guys each have 5 points through 2 games, right? When your top guys are averaging 2.5 points, you know, you're going to be pretty excited about that. It's just a matter of Can they contain Tampa? And you got to stay out of the box. Tampa Bay's power play is just that good. And you give them like that series, Frank, has had the most power play opportunities. Tampa's had 12 and Toronto's had 10 so far. And if that continues, as good as Toronto, I just Kucherov and them, their history in the postseason power play, that's an advantage. Toronto's got a, and so does Tampa Bay, because Toronto has a pretty good power play. But I'm kind of surprised at how many, at times, undisciplined penalties there's been on both sides.
So you mentioned Vasilevsky bouncing back in game two. How money was Victor Hedman?
Oh.
He was awful in game one. As bad as I've ever seen him look. And game two, 4 points, threading the needle on a long distance, 125 foot pass. Just vintage Victor Hedman.
Well, that's why, like, if you asked me to take one defenseman, I would still take Victor Hedman. And not because I don't like Roman Josi and Cale Makar are unreal, but they're not 6'5" and 230 pounds. And I think when you can do, and he can be the offensive guy, Frank, and he takes up so much more space in the defensive zone. When he's on, I still believe he's the best defenseman in the NHL.
I'm still taking Cale Makar every day.
All right. Yeah, I don't know if he can defend as well as Hedman overall. He's more dynamic.
Yeah, it's true, but I just think he gets the puck up and out with so much ease that the defending part is important, but it's also how quickly can you get the puck on your stick and get it out. So I think that's key. Let's get to our big guest of the day. Our next guest is the product of Sudbury, Ontario, the Nickel. He has been working in the Chicago Blackhawks front office for the last 12 years and was officially named their general manager on March 1st. The DFO Rundown is pleased to welcome Kyle Davidson. Kyle, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me. Excited to be here.
Yeah. So let's start with this. What is the last, 6, 8, 10 months been like for you? The season starts and obviously what played out with the investigation obviously threw things into a little bit of turmoil. You take over on an interim basis, go through the interview process, named general manager on March 1st. What's it been like?
Yeah, it's the season that felt like about 3 or 4 seasons, to be honest. It was a lot of ups and downs, a lot of uncertainty, you know, being the interim GM for quite some time. And then as we got along in the season, as interim, there were still lots of things to do and coaching change, bringing in Derek King. And then off the ice, the GM search was kind of something that was always in the background as well. So uncertainty there, just wondering what the future held for myself and what that would look like. And then going through the process and still acting as the interim general manager while all of the search and all the processes is going on in parallel. And so it's been a lot. It's been quite the year, but I've learned a ton. It's really given me an opportunity to dig into what's going on here on and off the ice. And then looking to the future to really build that within the image that I've created over the last little while in developing our plan and now into our executive team and then moving on to the off season for looking forward with the player personnel aspect of it. So it's been quite the year, but it's been very educational and really exciting too.
So what is the Kyle Davidson origin story? Like I mentioned, I was prepping for the interview and I'm like, we know what his roles have been over the last 12 years. How did you get to Chicago before that? What's your experience? Did you play minor hockey? How did you get to this role?
Yeah, I played hockey growing up in Sudbury. Not at any level or anything that I would throw on my resume as any hockey cred or anything like that. But I did play and loved the game. Started out helping out with the Sudbury Wolves and in the OHL and really just kind of doing anything that they would have me do, whether that be helping out in game day promotions with the hope that I could get into hockey operations. Eventually got into the draft room, helped out with the draft. But Then I went to Laurentian University in Sudbury, and upon graduating, I got an internship actually with the Rockford IceHawks, and it was a sales / hockey ops internship, which is quite the amalgamation of two disciplines.
And I like so, it.
Yeah. But the thing that happened, the work visa didn't actually work out once I got down there. And so I had like a period of time where either I leave the country or I just had to leave the country or find another employer that was willing to work out a work visa for me. And it just happened that the hockey operations intern at the time with the Chicago Blackhawks went back for, I think, get their master's or something like that. And so that opened up and, but you know, it took a couple of days and I was in with the Blackhawks, immigration solidified and off to the races. So that's how I started in Chicago. It's just random luck that I went down to Rockford on an internship and it didn't work out there, but something opened up in Chicago at the same time that I was down in Rockford.
And so now I'm pretty sure you were a video analyst early on with the Blackhawks, correct?
Right.
And so yeah. On the videos, were you thinking more coaching potential or were you always somebody who thought more management?
No, always management. And that video analyst, that was, I think that was almost like a pre analytics tracking title. That's what it was. Essentially I was tracking all of our passes. And you know, pass location between, you know, who it was between and trying to determine passing synergies and who was working well on the ice together. And so that was my first job out of the internship. They hired me full time to continue that work. And so that's what I did. That was fairly short lived, but that was my first full time responsibility with the Blackhawks.
So as somebody then who's tracked certain things, like obviously analytics plays a part and I think there can be some good from it, but how do you differentiate between, you know, what the analytics says, but what it means, right? Because I think that the key for the best analysts is to look at what the numbers suggest, but then say, okay, is this really actually occurring and how do you do it? So when you were breaking down stuff, did you ever learn something where you thought, okay, I think this is what it means, but now after studying all the video, that actually isn't what I thought it meant?
I don't know if I was getting that in depth with it. I think, you know what? For me, the most beneficial part of watching all of those games and tracking at the time I did was, one, the team was really, really good at that time.
Yeah.
And I just got to see tendencies of really great players that are not natural tendencies that you'll see or you'd probably ever teach. Like some of the things that Duncan Keith does on the ice, whether it's with the puck or in defending, you know, in 2010, like you wouldn't tell people to do that, but his skating and his instincts were so elite that he would do it and he would be able to pull it off. And so, getting back to a more general sense of, you know, what you're seeing versus what might actually be going on, you always have to be analyzing critically and not necessarily making too hard of a judgment on any one direction based on any one piece of information and always looking for something else that you're not looking to confirm, but you're just looking to round out your understanding. And so it's always asking questions, always being critical of what maybe your eyes are seeing or what you're reading and going back to another way of evaluation to round out whatever conclusion you're trying to make.
So where was your next step, Kyle, after starting out as an analyst and an intern?
Oh boy. At that time, I think it would have been my first foray into CBA management or like CBA analysis. I did so many different things around along the way that I was kind of hopping around. And I think at that time it was getting into the CBA and really kind of getting familiar with things like, you know, roster limit rules and IR rules and just the very basic nuts and bolts of roster composition. And at that time too, I also went down and helped out again with the hockey ops department in Rockford to really understand the minor league system. And I traveled with the team a little bit for a couple of years down there and got to know, you know, how players are developing and what's beneficial for them to work on and how the coaching staff should, you know, communicate with the players and with Chicago management. So That was there. There was like this period for myself of like 2 to 3 years of just really jumping in and helping out in various parts, helping organize amateur scouting meetings, helping set up pro scouting meetings and being involved in all those. But, you know, being on the back end, the day-to-day operations of things, I was kind of helping out in every aspect.
But that's obviously been hugely beneficial to your career in the sense that you got to know a little bit of everything that happens. And you need that if you're ever going to be the manager. I don't know that at any point while you're doing those things, anyone's saying, hey, this guy is going to be the next GM of the Chicago Blackhawks. How did you manage that just from a sort of career perspective? I think everyone, you know, as a young person coming up in any industry, you're like, okay, what's my title? What's my role here? Who do I report to? How does this work? Were you comfortable just sort of floating in between, and who was communicating with you? Who were you looking up to say, okay, this is where I, you know, ultimately like to get to? How did those conversations unfold?
Yeah, I was someone that was very aware of what I wanted to do. I did want to be a general manager, and you don't know how realistic a goal or expectation that is, but
how many other interns come in, Kyle, and are like, yeah, I want to be a GM. Like almost everyone.
I never got in anyone's face about it. Like, hey, I'm going to be this or I'm going to do that. No, that's not my personality. And my goal was actually, I just want to be qualified to be a GM because there's so much that goes into getting these jobs, right place, right time, connection, whatever it is. There's so much that's not controlled on your end to get a general manager's job. And so my goal was just to be qualified. And I just wanted to experience every different aspect of the hockey operations department. And, you know, I never heard no along the way, which was a huge benefit to me. You know, early on, I think, and throughout my career, the one person that I'd always leaned on for advice and really getting perspective on and getting his thoughts and picking his brain. It's the reason why I brought him back is Norm McIver. And he was someone I was talking the other day that the first day I met Norm, he's like, oh, I'm driving down to St. Louis tomorrow to watch. I still remember the Dallas Stars and St. Louis Blues. Do you want to come? And so of course, yeah. So I hop in the car and just peppered him with questions for 4.5 hours on the way there and sat with him and watched the game and peppered him with questions on the way back. And then we've always had that relationship of bouncing ideas off each other and really, it really helped for me to solidify what I thought about players and form my own opinions and to disagree with him along the way too, but have that healthy dialogue of going back and forth. And he's someone that he played. After he played, he coached, then he joined the Blackhawks in a development role and then got into scouting. So again, someone that's seen many different facets of the hockey industry. So it's just always been a really great resource for me.
Kyle, it's interesting you come in, you know, you're one of the younger GMs in the league. And we've seen that before in sports, really. And then there's been lots of guys who have had success with it. When you come in and now you're the decision maker, right? And I know the Jay Woodcroft talked about, hey, being an assistant coach is one thing. The biggest difference is now I make the final say, right? Like you still, at the end of the day, you talk to other people, you have assistant GMs, but ultimately now, you know, the buck stops here with Kyle Davidson. As you prepared and you said, this is something you always wanted to do. What's the next step now? How do you ensure to be a good leader as the GM? What do you think are the key things for you moving forward that's going to make you successful as a GM?
Yeah, you know, I think there's an aspect of just staying true to who I am as a person as well. I don't want to change. I don't want to change who I am and how I treat people because I am the final decision maker and I am in you know that big chair. But I think it's creating this plan and having everyone understand and communicate what I'm looking for throughout the organization to the different verticals within hockey operations and make sure what's expected of everyone and what I'm looking for from their group. And so it's always the constant communication, the constant understanding of how they're going to benefit us in the long run, how they're going to play a role in our success and how they can help us get back to where we want to be and just keeping them part of the process. I don't want to cut anyone out. I want it to be a very collaborative effort and bring them along with us, you know, every staff, because every person that works here is going to play a role and play an important role in getting us back to where we need to be and making sure they know what's expected of them and how they're going to benefit the organization moving forward. So, it's a different role, absolutely. But I think there's some aspects of it that have come naturally to me, and you don't know that until you're in the seat. And so that's been something that's been very reassuring, because again, you don't know until you really step into it, how you're going to assimilate, but it's gone really well. And our staff has been unbelievable in reacting to everything that I've given them.
Kyle, it's a fine line. Rebuild, retool, rebuilds are rarely as quick as everybody would like to be. When you look at them historically, it's kind of like an 8 to 10 year thing sometimes. Right. Now that you're in the chair, you look at your organization. Patrick Kane just had his third best season of his career. He was, you know, he carried the offense more than any player in the NHL. Actually, he was in on 44% of the Blackhawks goals. Right. Him and Jonathan Toews are obviously being legends in Chicago. Is one of your first steps ensuring kind of where they fit in the future if they want to be? And then do you decide from there? What's the step for your organization?
I don't think the organizational direction is determined by any one player or group of players. I think we're going to set out on our path and our plan outside of what is decided in those instances. Having said that, they deserve to know what's going on, and they deserve to know their role in that plan. And that's something that I think is very important. Just one, because, you know, Patrick and Jonathan have done a lot for the organization, and they're still contributors. They're still here and they're still helping this team in a big way. And so they deserve to know how they're part of that or how they can be part of that within our plan. And so that's a key aspect of this, but any one player or two players, that's not going to dictate if we change course, if we change our horizon on time horizon on where we're looking to go, because there's a lot of work to do here, both on and off the ice. And we've got to make sure we're doing that right and getting that right. And then we'll figure out the players and how their timeline matches up with ours.
So one of the most interesting things that I thought you said after the season wrapped up was you're not here to sell anyone. You're going to have a conversation with Patrick and Jonathan and explain what that role is. And then it's going to be up to them to decide. But I think sort of historically, the way that this has all played out when having, you know, sort of more difficult conversations like these ones, given their contributions to an organization, that it ends up becoming a sell job one way or the other, that it's either, you know, we're selling you to tell us, hey, you know, it's time to go, like, get me out of here, or to try and keep them. Why is it important for you to just lay it out and then let them decide?
Well, there's a couple different things, because, you know, we need to build the franchise in the organization to a point that we can sustain success. And that is going to take time. We're just not at a point where we can reload or retool and get back to where we want to be and trust that we can stay there for a longer period of time. And so that's one aspect of it. The other aspect of giving them the information and letting them decide is they do control their fates. If they want to stay, if they want to, you know, we can't unilaterally move them. Not that we would, but that's a discussion. That's a talking point for both sides where, you know what, this is what we're doing, and they deserve to know that, you know, they've put in so much time and done so much for the franchise that we're at a point where they just need to know what we're going to be doing. And if they want to be part of that, there's a role for them. If they think that they want to explore something else, then, you know, that's something we'll try to accommodate. But it's just we're not anywhere near that point yet. We're discussing, we're letting them know what's going on and what we're thinking. And, you know, we don't really have a time horizon. And I know that's always a hot button question, but it's when it comes to players of their magnitude, it's always important just to to let them know and to bring them in on the process and give them an idea of what's going on in your head so they can make the best decisions for themselves.
So you've been kind of transparent in that right from the very beginning, though. I was told, you know, March 1st, your name general manager, before you even came out to speak to the media and gave your sort of, you know, idea or vision of what it might be like and use the word rebuild, that you gathered, you know, a group of the core leaders to say, hey, here's what I'm going to say before I'm going to tell you first before I go out and say it publicly. You know, what was the message that you gave them then?
That was just because I knew what I felt needed to be done. I knew what, you know, my mandate was going to be walking into that first press conference and how I was going to be messaging my intentions for the future. And so I didn't want them to be hearing about that through Twitter or through news stories. You know, that's something that's very big to a franchise that they've either committed a lot of time to and given their lives to in Patrick and Jonathan's case. And then in Seth Jones's case, he's committed long-term moving forward. And so they deserve to hear that from me on what my intentions were moving forward. And I wanted them to hear that directly from me, just so they got that from my mouth rather than reading about it and then having to ask, you know, whether it be agents or friends or other teammates, what does that mean? You know, no, here's what I'm going to say, guys. This is what my intention is. I want you to hear from me rather than read it through news stories. And so I just thought that was the right way to kick off what I knew would be an ongoing dialogue with some of our cornerstone players.
Kyle, you came out earlier this week. Your two assistant coaches won't be back, but Derek King is still in the running for the head coaching job. What's your timeline on when you would like to have a head coach in place? Do you feel it has to be before the draft sometime? Well, I would assume before free agency. What's the timeline and what specifically will you be looking for your next head coach?
Yeah, the timeline we're not being too firm on. I think the dates that you mentioned in the calendar are some that, you know, we're going to be very mindful of, and we'd like to have something in place in and around that time period, that mid-July time period. As far as what we're looking for in the next head coach, you know, the one thing that I always come back on is the communication. Communication is so important, and whether it be for veteran players, whether it be for younger players who you're trying to develop and help improve, you know, they all need to know what the message is from a team standpoint, from an individual standpoint. And then I think that helps drive style of play. It helps drive culture. So that's a main point. And then I also just want to get into the room with some of these candidates and hear their perspective on style of play, on where the game might be going, on how they want to handle a locker room. And so there's lots to be learned. We have some of our general ideas that what we want out of a person, communication and being near the top of the list. And so, but I think it's going to be exciting to get in the room with some of these candidates and really hear their take on how they'd run a room and the state of hockey.
You also announced an interesting hire for me anyway, a guy that was competing for your job with your, maybe competing is the wrong word, but got interviewed for the GM job in Jeff Greenberg. You guys brought him over from the Chicago Cubs. He called you, I'm told, after you got the job to congratulate you. And then the conversation just came. And so now he's your associate GM and he's going to be part of this, I think, strategic systems and processes and stuff in hockey operations. What was it about those conversations? Did you know Jeff at all? And did you feel that if the organization people thought he was that good, it's better to have more good people around me rather than be worried about, oh, here's somebody else that the organization was even considering?
Yeah. So it started out, I didn't know Jeff before. I knew his name from the GM process, but I had not met him. And so when he reached out, he actually reached out via text, you know, just, hey, congratulations. It's really, really great process and, you know, best of luck. And then we just kept trading text messages, eventually hopped on the phone and eventually met in person. And just through our discussions and learning about what he did with the Cubs and his path, because we do have very similar paths. We took these very parallel roads to where we had gotten. We both started as interns, and so we're reminiscing on some of our early times with the Cubs, and then myself, the Blackhawks, and all the different jobs we had done. But he started giving me insight into the different aspects of baseball operations that he was involved with, specifically these system builds and how they use their systems to inform decision making. And it was such a unique, interesting insight into how decisions can be arrived at and how useful gathering and storing and housing system in a very strategic way is, can be advantageous to not just baseball or hockey, any sports operation. Mm-hmm. It's just managing your information in a better way. And so he's seen the build on how you go about that process and how you go about hiring specific people for certain jobs and the skill sets needed to get to where you want to go. And so it was such a unique, fascinating path and such a great experience base that was something I had intended on bringing in. And when he spelled out all the things he did, it's like, well, this is the guy, like, this is, yeah. I want him. And so, and like you said, I'm not worried about the fact that he did go far in our GM search. I think that's great. That speaks to his qualifications and to the person and the characteristics that he brings to the table that our you know, leadership here brought him to that level of the process. And so I want to surround myself with the best people. And to me, I've got Norm on one side and Jeff on the other. They both attack things in a different way, but they're both uniquely qualified, I believe, to be GMs. And so I've got people that are at a very high level and helping me make decisions every single day that, you know, I think I've got a great team around me that really rounds out the decision-making process from every aspect that I'd want to hit a problem with. So I'm really happy with it. And I'm really excited for Jeff to come in and get going.
When you were going through that process with Jeff, was it a reminder at all of really how much room hockey still has to grow, in the sense that baseball, football, you know, basketball, there just seems to be, they're at different levels in terms of progress, specifically when it comes to strategy. Like, you hear, and I talk to other people in front offices that are in conversation with people in Premier League football or whatever it is, that they kind of ask questions of hockey. Like, wait, you still do it that way? Like, what, how much room does hockey have to grow, Kyle?
You know, I can't necessarily speak for other teams. I think, you know, there, I definitely saw an opportunity and an opening for the Chicago Blackhawks to grow. And so it was something that I felt was absolutely necessary. So, you know, there's lots to be learned, and there's lots of things that can be translated across sports that are not sports specific. And here at the Blackhawks, and again, I've only worked at one team in the NHL, so I can't speak to what's going on elsewhere, but what we're doing here, this was an opportunity to improve. It was an opportunity to really bring in a new way of doing things and a new way of making decisions and gathering information and helping the executive leadership arrive at conclusions. And baseball and the Cubs specifically are a group that does that very well. And so bringing in one of the people that was an architect in that process and in that systems build was just an awesome opportunity. And so we never want to stop learning. We never want to stop improving. And if that's learning something from baseball, from Premier League football, from NFL, then we're going to do that. And we're going to take anything we can to improve our operation. And this was the first and a very big example of that.
So one of the things we talk about often on this pod, and Jason says it all the time, is a rebuild takes 8 years when you look at it really from start to finish. What was the conversation like when you're presenting your vision of what the Blackhawks will be over the next number of years? What's that conversation like with ownership going through the interview process, or whoever it is that you're meeting with, to explain, hey, this is the path forward, and this is why I believe this is the right one, and this is also how long it's going to take to really be competitive again? What is your view of that in terms of how quickly the Blackhawks can be top competitors again?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of things that go into timeline and you know, really getting back to where you want to be. I think that's really hard to pin down and forecast right now. The thing that I spoke to and that I truly believe is that we were just lacking in certain areas, specifically our depth at the NHL level, at the prospect level, that we needed to rebuild. And that does take time. And so we need to, you know, bring talent to the NHL, and then we need to keep talent coming and keep it coming in waves. And that means being better at drafting, at developing, at our strategic budgeting, and keeping talent around once we bring it here under the salary cap. And so a lot of those things went into, you know, my view on the world and my view of the Chicago Blackhawks and how I saw this thing moving forward and how we needed to build back up. And, you know, I was never asked to put a timeline on it. You know, we do understand that this is a significant project. And so there's no, you know, confusion on that, but specific timeline, we don't know, because, you know, you don't know how quickly players are able to step in and be impact players right out of their draft now. And, or if you need extra time, there's just too many variables there. So I just focused on what we needed to fix and doing it right. And doing it to a point where we could sustain being in a spot that's competitive year over year. And it may take time. It may take shorter. It may take longer than anyone thinks. That remains to be seen. But what we're doing is we're committed to doing it the right way and making sure that when we do get to where we want to be, we stay there.
So this is a pretty big summer in terms of kickstarting that process, not just in terms of hiring the right people to surround yourself with, which you mentioned you partly have already done. I'm sure there's other changes you'd like to make throughout the departments and also in getting that next head coach in. But how do you make the decision in terms of really who stays and who goes? Some of that we mentioned with some of your older veteran core guys, they'll make the decision in a lot of ways for themselves. But when you're dealing with an Alex DeBrincat who eventually needs a new contract, an expensive one at that after a 40 goal season, and a Seth Jones who we talked about very briefly, but, you know, signed on sort of for one path and is now about to go down another one that he maybe wasn't necessarily expecting. How do you manage those and how do you decide who stays and who goes?
Yeah, it all goes into the mix and we're going to consider every option because, you know, we're not in a position to be too strict on, you know, just going one way or keeping a whole group of guys. You know, there's going to be some turnover. Let's be honest here, that we need to make some changes and we need to build towards the future. And so a lot of that too, though, you don't get to dictate what direction you go. You have to have a partner in something like a trade and you don't get to name the price. And then once you do get into some discussions on whoever those players or prospects or you know, picks may be, you have to determine the value proposition there. And if that's in the best interest moving forward, and if not, then you don't force anything. You kind of have to take what's going to come. And, you know, we've already made a couple moves that have given us some good draft capital in this year's draft and the years moving forward. And we'll look to capitalize on that. And, you know, but we're also, you know, we're going to explore every avenue to enhance our prospect pool, to strengthen that draft capital and to bring in potentially some young players. And so we're not ruling anything out one way or the other. I think it's really important to stay nimble and stay agile and just take what comes and not force anything, because once we start forcing things, then, you know, you start making mistakes and we want to be very intentional with what we do in the summer.
Last one for me before we get to rapid fire. You know, just when we were talking about your path here and your origin story, you know, I didn't necessarily realize how much time you had spent in Rockford. And as you're looking at this team, I feel like in some ways the minor league process or part of it is often overlooked a little bit in terms of the development. You know, a lot of times you have high picks and they sort of make it right to the NHL pretty quickly and whatnot. How big a role will Rockford play in what you want to do?
Rockford's going to be critical in the role that they play in the development process and for the Blackhawks in general, because like right now, we've got, there's an opportunity they play tonight, an opportunity to close out their play-in series against Texas. And that is such invaluable experience for all of our young players. And they're getting to play playoff hockey. They're getting to experience high leverage situations and they're being used. It's not like we've got prospects down there that are playing 7 minutes a night. No, they're playing 20 plus minutes a night in playoff hockey and professional in a professional league at a very young age. And so it's super valuable. It also gives us touch points to develop and teach along the way and really help them hone the skills that are going to bring them to the NHL and help them stick at the NHL. And so that's the one advantage to Rockford, where normally if you draft a player and they go to college, they're in Europe or they're in the CHL or wherever they may be, you don't have that daily touch point. You can give them pointers, but they've got their own coaches. They've got their own system that they're playing. In Rockford, you can bring them and really put day-to-day work in with them to help them assimilate to a system, help them work on what they need to work on and really get the reps in to see that improvement, you know, week over week and month over month. So Rockford is going to play a huge part in all this moving forward. And, you know, they are right now as well. And so hopefully they can continue going on this playoff run, that they can sustain some success here and play some extra games. And it's all great for the development of our prospects, and it's all bonus development time for them to get that important experience.
Kyle, we like to end with rapid fire. The only rule is you have to answer the questions. All right.
Okay. Deal.
Okay. Perfect. Well, we'll start with a few easier ones. When Kyle Davidson's officially named the GM of the Blackhawks, what's your celebratory alcoholic or non-alcoholic beverage?
Well, I found out at 7:30 in the morning. It was a breakfast meeting with Danny Wirtz, so it was a coffee.
Yeah. What if you had found out at 7:30 at night, what would it have been?
Well, the one thing I talked about at my introductory press conference, I've had three open heart surgeries. So probably just I've had three, I was born with a congenital heart defect. And so I had three open heart surgeries. So I'm pretty
healthy and
careful with the alcoholic beverages. So, but it's not that I don't drink. So maybe a glass of red wine.
Glass of red wine. Well, they say red wine, a glass is good for your heart, man. Three open hearts.
Doctor's orders, right?
That's amazing. If people are coming to Chicago, is there a jazz club that you would recommend they go to?
Boy, I used to live near Kingston Mines over in Lincoln Park. So that's a pretty big one.
Okay. Non-hockey, if there's one sporting event that you would like to go watch, which one and why?
I'd probably like to go watch either the World Cup final or the Champions League final. I'm a big soccer fan. I've loved it since I was young. And so that would be one of those two events.
So as a younger GM, how many times a day do you check Twitter?
You know what? One of the things I've done intentionally since I've become a GM is not check Twitter. And so fewer times, I don't know, a couple of times, but I'm not on it and consuming it like I used to. I try and steer clear a little bit.
And I say that because different generations, like younger generations, have grown up on their phone and, you know, in social media. Sure. And so your players have it a lot. Which Blackhawk player do you think would make the best TikTok videos?
Oh my goodness. I really have no clue on that.
Who's funny?
I think Kevin Lankin is a pretty interesting guy. I think he'd do well.
It's okay. Always the goalies. Louis Domingue he's into baking. That's a big thing
this week.
He's back in net. The goalies show their personality. That's why they end up on TV a lot.
Right.
How closely do you watch NHL playoff games? Are you watching a specific series or do you watch as many games a night as you can?
I watch as much as I can. I try and watch a game until, you know, if it's kind of getting out of hand or you know, the score gets to a point where you kind of determine, you know, what's going to happen, then I'll switch to a closer game. But I try and watch every single game. We're only two games into each series, but I think I've watched parts of every single game that's been played so far. And so, because you're always learning, you're always understanding what's going on, what other teams are doing structure wise, matchup wise, how certain players are playing. So I'm watching all the time.
Most memorable piece of advice you got from someone that has helped you in your career?
I think it was probably back in the Sudbury Wolves days. You know, one of the, and it wasn't like a one line or anything, but former GM, his name is Blaine Smith. He gave me a piece of advice just on relationships that, you know, treat every interaction as the most important interaction you're going to have, because you never know when that's going to come back or how that's going to impact your reputation. Just treat everyone first class and just kind of keep that going forward, because everything comes full circle at some point.
In your video analyst that you watched about passing, what was your most important takeaway that you learned from those videos?
Probably how amazing Duncan Keith was, and still is. Like, he's still playing big minutes for the Edmonton Oilers. It was just getting to watch him and getting to see him move the puck and transport the puck, and even when I wasn't tracking passes defending, probably one of the, you know, I haven't seen as much hockey as some people, but he's one of the best players I've ever seen.
Yeah, he's pretty elite. Patrick Kane's stick handling. I don't know if you're watching stick handling more than passing, but he's pretty. If Norm McIver, who was a pretty good defenseman in his own right, Kyle, if you were scouting today, how much better would Norm McIver's game be in today's NHL back when he played in, and he was really good then, but you look at a Norm McIver in 2022, who would he compare to?
I don't know. He's.
We're gonna send him a clip, just so you know.
Yeah, I don't watch. I didn't watch much Norm McIver hockey, but what I would say is you got to clean up the defensive end, man. You got to clean that up. I know you love playing the point on the power play, but try defending once in a while.
Kyle, thanks so much. And quickly, give us an update on the open heart surgery. Is everything good now? What's the prognosis?
Oh yeah, I'm good. I had a corrective procedure to replace my pulmonic valve back in November 2019, and so it's been unbelievable. I feel great. Honestly, you don't really know that anything's wrong, and then they tell you you need heart surgery again, which my other ones were right at when I was born, but I didn't really know anything was wrong, and so, you know, just regular heart checkups and got the surgery, and after the surgery, it's like, oh, this is what I'm supposed to feel like. This is great. And so I'm feeling awesome, you know, annual checks and everything's been great. And so no complaints. I'm in a good spot, and I'm lucky to have the care that I have here in Chicago. So it's been good.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much for joining us, Kyle, and best of luck. Your first year as a GM of the Chicago Blackhawks.
Thanks, guys. Appreciate it.
Kyle Davidson, that was our big guest today, brought to you by DoorDash. Ding dong. I can't do it as well as Liam does, but you use the promo code RUNDOWNDD. That will get you 25% off and free delivery on your first order. So check it out. Promo code RUNDOWNDD. And quite the story, Frank, from Kyle Davidson on how he became a GM. I think it's a fascinating path for a lot of people who weren't like elite hockey players, right? Like it just shows you that there's different ways. If you have a goal in mind, there's different ways to approach it to become an NHL GM.
Crazy. I love his story. I love that he, you know, dabbled in just about every little area of the Chicago Blackhawks. I think that's really how you become well-rounded. And I think it's an important lesson for anyone in any field, not just wants to work in hockey, is float around. If someone offers you the opportunity to drive down to St. Louis to watch a game, take it. It's one of the big things, pieces of advice that I give to anyone who asks, is never say no.
Yes.
Find a way, whatever someone asks you to do, find a way to say yes when you're working your way up through the business. It goes a long way. And when you get the opportunity to meet people, pick their brains, talk to them, they remember you because you're that eager person that wants to learn, and it's not eager or hungry to take their job. It's, you know, you have an opportunity to ask questions of someone who's an expert in their field, take it. And, you know, vice versa, when you get in that spot, pay it forward and answer those questions and take someone along for the ride.
Yeah, 100%. And hey, Frankie, speaking of the ride, have a good birthday weekend. The 3-4. Nice. What's on tap for the birthday weekend for Frank Saravalli?
Absolutely nothing. Honestly, this first week of the playoffs has been a grind, a lot of late nights. I am looking forward to doing nothing. And we asked Kyle, what would be his sporting event of choice if he could do or see one thing? For me, it would be the Kentucky Derby. I was born on Derby Day. Saturday, tomorrow, my birthday is also Derby Day. So pretty awesome. I'd love to do it once.
Well, dude, you're going to have to go. Yeah, that'd be sick, man. You got the
Hard time of year for a hockey reporter, writer to go to Kentucky for a few days.
One time, though, man, you got to go. We have the Canadian Derby in Edmonton all the time. And I just like going just to dress it up, man. It's sick. Like, I suck at betting. I never picking on the ponies, but I like doing it. It's just a lot of fun.
And, I used to hang around the track a lot.
Oh, man, huge. Like, we get the infield pass. And so the power of those horses, man, it's unreal. When you're literally, like, when they come flying down and you're standing and they're running by you.
Rail.
Oh, it is an awesome thing. Now, obviously, the Kentucky Derby is a little bit different level. It'd be probably a little bit challenging to get right on the rail. There's a lot of people there, but that's a really good answer. I like that event. That'd be loads of fun to go to just for the opportunity to really go in with a sick ass wardrobe. That's what I would want.
Mm-hmm. Well,
yeah,
dress that it up. And also just the experience. I'd love to just see it one time.
What's the special Derby drink they have? You know,
mint julep.
The mint julep, yes. I have a few of those.
Little Woodford Reserve bourbon, and
yes, I got a bottle of that, buddy. That's pretty good. So. Yep. Awesome, Frank. Have a great weekend. We talk Monday. Who knows? Maybe some teams could already be out.
The Boston Bruins.
Stanley Cup playoffs. Yeah, I guess that's the only team, but we'll see. And until then, have everybody a great weekend. Enjoy the playoffs.
Thanks for listening to the DFO Rundown with Saravalli and Gregor. Keep it locked on dailyfaceoff.com and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts from to never miss an episode. Delivered by DoorDash.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc. Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Are you ready for playoff hockey? Well, listen up, because I've got something for you. It's called the Daily Faceoff Playoff Parlay Challenge, and it's going to add some serious spice to your playoff experience. Now, here's the deal. Every playoff game day, you're going to be faced with four questions. It's like your own personal playoff puzzle. And here's a sneak peek into some of the questions we'll be firing your way. First up, you got to pick the winning team. Simple, right? But there's more. You got to decide if the total for the game is going to go over or under a certain amount, and the strategy doesn't stop there. Next up, you're picking which player is going to light the lamp first, and finally, you got to predict which period in the game is going to be the highest scoring. Will it be a barn burner in the first, a shootout in the second, or a nail biter in the third? That is all up to you. Now let's talk prizes, because who doesn't love winning stuff? Daily winners, you're getting hooked up with gift cards. That's right. Treat yourself to some nation gear or even your favorite jersey. And for the big dogs, the round winners, cash money, cold hard cash. We're putting real dough in your pockets simply for your hockey knowledge. So lace up those skates, stretch those thumbs, and get ready to show off your hockey IQ in the Daily Faceoff Playoff Parlay Challenge. It's game time, folks. Head over to games.dailyfaceoff.com now and prove your puck prowess.